'cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor.
I caught up with the indefatigable Erica Zhang, who has been on book tour since September. Please note, it is November. And she told me how to wear hot pants, how to live fearlessly, and why grandmothers should be the ones in charge of war. Erica Zhang, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. You're gorgeous. What can I tell you?
As are you. And you have been publishing since 1972.
Right, the 71, my first book of poems.
Which was Fruits and Vegetables?
That's right.
And I read somewhere that you publicized Fruits and Vegetables by standing on a crate.
In a fruit and vegetable market. Yes, that is true. And there, somewhere on my website, there are pictures of that.
Oh, fantastic.
So of me wearing purple lace hot pants.
Worth it alone.
71 was the summer of 71. Hot pants were in, right? Whatever they were. I mean, they were little shorts. Mm-hmm. And you wore, and they were purple lace, and you wore purple lace sort of tunic over them. Mm-hmm. And you were supposed to not wear a bra, but I don't know if I was braless. But you know, it was the 70s. Mm-hmm. And now when my daughter, who is 37, says, "Oh, Mommy, all the 70s fashions are back," I think, oh.
That was your first experience with publishing. 2 years later, you come out
with Fear of Flying. Right. Which I wrote throughout my 20s, which I was working on throughout my 20s. Well.
That must have been terrifying.
Well, you're the only person who realizes that. Mm. I'm a graduate student at Columbia getting my PhD. I've published 2 volumes of poetry that won all the prizes, okay? All the prizes that were won by Sylvia Plath and W.S. Merwin. And then I published this novel, and all of a sudden, I'm the happy hooker of literature. And it was just crazy. I remember going, apropos of that, I remember going to a literary festival in Montreal. And my editor called me on the phone, my paperback editor, and she said, "Erica, whatever you do, please don't get photographed with the author of The Happy Hooker." So I walk into the convention hall in Montreal, and the woman who wrote The Happy Hooker comes running over to me, photographers at the ready, embraces me and says, "Oh, you're my sister." I mean, she was really a fiend for publicity. Mm. And she gets photographed with me. And that was typical of what happened to me with Fear of Flying.
Your story gets hijacked, you know, in a way. And
fame is not what it's cracked up to be. Especially, you know, I'm grateful that I became a household name. It enables me to make a living as a writer, or almost a living. Less and less all the time because of the way publishing has changed. But it gave me a profession to have a household name. But people think things about fame that aren't true. If you want to see what fame is really about, see the movie about Amy Winehouse. You know, people just descend on you for their own ends. And some of them are stark raving mad.
And one of those ends, because of your book, you know, there are a couple of strands, the happy hooker, the zipless fuck, but also feminism. How you conduct your life almost becomes hijacked by that title, by that.
In a way. I mean, mm-hmm. That is true. But thank God I started out, or goddess, as a poet. And whenever things really got too exposed in my life, I went back and wrote poetry. And that gives you a degree of humility. First of all, nobody reads it.
I was saying, nobody reads it, nobody publishes it.
Nobody publishes it. But the other thing is, in some of the countries where my fiction's been published, they've translated my poetry. But many cultures are not poetry cultures. You know, Pablo Neruda in South America has been memorized by everybody. I mean, 20 Poems of Love and A Song of Despair. Every Spanish speaker in South America can recite those poems. But that's a culture that loves poetry. But that sort of grounds you when you have something that you do that is not about fame and can't be famous. There's a complete freedom there. But there is so much sexism about women's appearance. Mm-hmm. And often these snotty British journalists will say to me, "Do you regret having a facelift?" And I say, "I don't regret anything in my life." And then they say, "Isn't it anti-feminist?" And I say, "Our society is anti-feminist." Mm-hmm. Don't blame it on us. Mm-hmm. Our society judges women by our looks. Why put that on us? Mm. Do you think that Barbara Walters would have worked until the age of 80 if she hadn't had work done? Mm-hmm. Excuse me, would Christian Amanpour be working if she hadn't had work done? And that's the news business, honey. I have been a feminist my entire life.
I was going to say, my mother didn't have a choice.
No, my mother was a feminist. My grandmother, my mother's mother, only went to women doctors and women dentists, okay? Mm-hmm. My grandmother was of the, my mother's mother, was of the suffragist generation. She was a housewife, but the people she admired were the women who had become doctors.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, because I grew up the same way.
Did you?
And yet, from the outside, like your household, from the outside, it looked like a traditional household. My father worked, my mother stayed home, she read books, she was a doctor, but she didn't practice.
Why did she stop practicing?
She...
I'm going to start interviewing you. I know I'm not supposed to, but I get so bored with my own answers. But anyway.
But what is... Okay, and you work... Is it... When's it going to be... Is it fiscal parity...
It's a lot of things. I mean, in order to have a truly feminist society, we have to have fiscal parity, power parity, which means, look at the Congress of the United States. We have more women now than we ever had. And some of them, like Gillibrand, are great. Great. You know, future president, Senator Gillibrand. Not her time yet, but eventually. We have so many great women, but we have maybe... 18% of the Congress. Mm-hmm. And the rest of those old farts sit around trying to take health care away from women, poor women, when they have the best health care in the world. I mean, so there are various things. There's fiscal parity, power parity. There is stop making fun of women across the board. Deal with sexual violence, which is a worldwide pandemic, which we see much more clearly now because of the internet. We didn't see it before. Do you know that nobody keeps statistics on the number of women in the United States killed by their husbands or boyfriends? When a boyfriend kills the mother of his child and the child, it's in the headlines of the Murdoch press, you know, mm-hmm. for 3 days, and then forgotten. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is that violence by significant others against mothers and children is rampant mm-hmm. in the United States, and we don't even know how many that is. Feminism is about fiscal parity, power parity, and getting rid of this baleful press that mm-hmm. writes an article once a week saying feminism is dead.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is their favorite story. Feminism is now dead. I'm traveling through California, and I'm staying with my brother-in-law and sister-in-law and my niece and nephew in Bel Air. And my niece, who's 12, comes up to me and pins a button on me. And she has four friends there who are all 11 or 12. And they're all wearing buttons that say, "This is what a feminist looks like." Believe me, if the 12-year-olds... are saying that feminism is not dead, okay? That is not true. That's disinformation. Mm-hmm. And why is it put out there? you tell me. It's about disempowering 50%, 52% of the population.
Which is seen as threatening.
Yeah, well, seen as threatening, and also, sadly, it is true that in much of the world, women are shot in the head for wanting education, like Malala Yousafzai. That is the norm in the world. Now, wherever you have women getting educated, women starting businesses, women feeding their families through their own work, feeding their husbands through their own work or significant others or whatever, you have a standard of living rising. This has been shown for the last 30 years in every UN report on the status of women. You know, read Half the Sky. That book makes it crystal clear. Whether you're in Africa or the Middle East, wherever you are, whether it's a developing world or a more developed world, the minute women are educated and literate, the standard of living rises. The minute they're not, the standard of living falls. It's clear.
Well, it just makes sense numbers-wise. More is more. Yeah. You know, more people doing stuff, more people knowing stuff is more information transmitted to the second generation.
Right.
Which is more, you know what I mean? You just have more resources automatically.
Why should we disempower half the human race, and not only that, but the half of the human race that really cares about progress, that is not stuck in the past? I keep thinking the Native American tribes that had the Council of Grandmothers deciding on war and peace should be our model. The braves fought the wars with bows and arrows, later with firearms, whatever, but the grandmothers decided when to start the war and when to stop.
That's awesome. Because
yeah,
we are happy to send, you know, men are happy to send other men into war.
Oh, they love it. The young potent ones?
Yeah.
Get them out of here.
Exactly.
Right?
Whereas the grandmothers finally have the perspective.
They have perspective and, you know,
and the responsibility
and they honor take. And they honor life. Now, I hate to say honor life because in the U.S. that has become a term for no abortion, which is absurd to me. Mm-hmm. But grandmothers do honor life, and they want to preserve life. We, I should say we, because I'm the grandmother of four amazing kids.
Yeah.
And my whole perspective has changed. I recently wrote a poem about the dead toddler on the beach of Sappho's Island, Mytilene. Mm-hmm. An island I know very well because I wrote a novel about Sappho. But it's this weird thing that happens when you become a grandmother. All the toddlers are your toddlers. Boys, girls, whatever. And children, we forget, are the main victims of war.
Mm-hmm. Main victims of any violence.
Yes, exactly.
Is ultimately visited upon,
right,
upon
and
children.
The children.
Yeah.
Parents and children are the main victims of war. I just tweeted that today.
Author of The Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
We seem to be at a moment in time, and I think your daughter would probably agree, that though children still need to be fed, parents-in-law still need to be called, taken to doctor's appointments, taken care of, garbage still needs to get out of the house by some means or another, dishes need to be cleaned. It's looking at roles and valuing roles differently, I think, is important as well.
It hasn't gone far enough.
It hasn't gone really at all.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, I go to dinner at my English publisher's. He makes the meal and cleans up. He's a powerful publisher.
Sounds like a nice man.
In his 40s. Okay. That is good to see, but it doesn't happen everywhere. Mm-mm. It happens in an intellectual circle. I go to Norway. My Norwegian publisher is a delightful gay man who has a daughter of 12 by a surrogate. All his conversation is about his daughter, who's called Aida. And the partner he was with when the surrogate was found wasn't interested in parenting. He's a mad parent. So a lot of things are changing, but in very small circles. And there's a very strong fear movement to go back to the past. You know, look at the Congress of the United States. They want to go back. Back where? It's not even there anymore.
You've written a lot about fear. Mm-hmm. Okay, so your latest book, Fear of Dying.
Vanessa is struggling. I mean, she's struggling with becoming a grandmother. She's struggling with her dog dying. She's struggling with the fact that her very, very old parents are now becoming like her children. She's struggling with the fact that her husband has an aneurysm. I made him 20 years older. My husband is my age. But I think what's important is that all these events are converging. Also, she's out of work.
Yeah, I mean, she's the epitome of sandwich.
You know, right.
She's got older parents, she's got a sick husband, she's got a dying dog, she's nursemaid to those three, she's a pending grandmother. I mean, she is a sexually frustrated woman.
Right. So, and it all comes, I mean, I think that when you write a novel, it's really important to have a character with a problem, a major problem, which the arc of the plot will resolve in some way or other. Not, you know, things don't get resolved in life, but at least she will make a journey to understanding where and who she is. Also, it was important to me that she be an actress, because for people in the theater or movies, you hit 60, you don't get work.
Well, and also part of your career and your calling, what you do is being seen.
Right.
And you're no longer seen. And a part of you is no longer exists in that way.
Right, exactly.
Very palpably.
And I have so many really dear, close friends who are actors. And one of my closest friends, Shirley Knight, who's veering towards 80 now, when she turned 60, I mean, she's a fucking genius, this woman. I mean, Tennessee Williams wrote plays for her. Amiri Baraka wrote plays for her. She was one of the greats of her generation. When she turned 60, she said to me, "I'm ready to play Lear, but they're going to make me play the granny or the green-faced crone. I just know my craft now." And the frustration these women in the profession feel, and it was important to the book that I have a heroine for whom aging means the end of work.
And back to Fear of Dying, which was not the original title, but back to Fear of Dying, you have reintroduced Isadora Wing.
Right.
From Fear of Flying.
I love her.
Yeah, and she's wonderfully wise.
Yeah.
Now she's become a wonderfully wise woman.
Well, we do eventually get wise, I think.
Yeah.
I should have called the book Wise Women or something, but maybe that will be the next one.
That'll be the next one.
But, you know, what's so crazy about it with Isadora, I tried very hard to write the last Isadora book, and I couldn't find her voice.
Mm.
And then I thought, well, more dramatic anyway if the heroine is an actor, because the age beauty thing is so much more powerful for an actor. So then I found Vanessa's voice. You know, without voice, there's no novel. So when I found that, I thought she's a great narrator because all the issues are very dramatic in her life. And I gave her a billionaire husband, which I don't have, because money does not solve these problems.
Mm-mm.
People think it does, right? You still get old. You still have issues with your career, even if you don't need to make a living from it. You are still treated with sexism if you're a woman. And I thought, people didn't understand why is Asher a billionaire? I wanted to take that debate off the table. And I know a lot of billionaires. And believe me, the women married to them do not have it easier.
No.
They don't.
Well, I would think that, you know, that age beauty thing is even more palpable. The demands. I mean, I would think it would be a more sexist segment of society than middle class.
My husband always laughs at me because during the decade that I was single, I dated some of these masters of the universe. Couldn't stand them. They were such narcissists. And my daughter always says, Mommy, you could have married so-and-so, and think of how easy our life would be. And I said, do you really think I could be married to a Republican, Molly? A Republican, as I call them. What would I do at breakfast time if he would say, anybody who wants to repeal the carried interest deduction is worse than Hitler? Mm-hmm. Which is what they say, yes. You know.
Well, it's like living with a dictator. It's a financial dictator.
Right.
You know, right. The same thing.
And I know enough men like that, mm-hmm. and I know their wives. And they expect a degree of caretaking that other men, mm-hmm. they don't know how to load the dishwasher. It's true that you can afford endless help, which is always nice, right?
She doesn't escape sibling rivalry. She doesn't escape, you know, her parents' messy deaths.
Right.
She doesn't escape a midlife crisis. I mean, men get to have midlife crisis, and that somehow we're relegated to having menopause. You know, yeah. But, you know, it's a midlife crisis.
There has been
really
too much garbage written about menopause, in my opinion. I had the most delicious menopause. Mm. I mean, it went on over a period of 15 years. I never had hot flashes. Mm-hmm. I never had insomnia. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's variable like everything else in life, you know, like pregnancy is variable. Mm-hmm. Nursing is variable. I loved nursing. My daughter did it for 3 days and said, I don't want to do this.
Not for me.
It's not for me. And I said, Molly, look, this is an individual choice. If you like it, do it. If you don't like it, don't do it. Women dictating to each other is not feminism. It is the opposite of feminism. Feminism is free choice.
Is that also how we live fearlessly?
Yes. I think that we make our own choices based on our own self-knowledge.
Honesty.
Honestly, looking at yourself, trying to understand the self-destructive patterns in your life, good therapy with a feminist shrink who gets you.
I see a tendency as we get older to be more fearful of loss because we now know what it means. So are you scared of your own death, of your husband's death?
I'm scared of my husband's death because he did have an aneurysm in his 50s. Mm. And he made an amazing recovery. And he also transformed in many ways as a human being by being so close to his own death.
Thank you, fearless Erica Zhang. Fear of Dying is out now from Canongate.
RadioGorgeous.com.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore. And I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down.